Funding for Here and Now comes from the MathWorks, creators of MATLAB and Simulink technical computing software, on the web at mathworks.com.
Mandatory evacuation orders are in place for New Orleans and Galveston, Texas, as Hurricane Rita charges toward the West Gulf Coast. Forecasters anticipate late landfall late Friday night or Saturday morning, most likely in Texas. Rita skirted the Florida Keys as a Category 2 storm, but has intensified now to Category 4, with winds of at least 140 miles per hour and a possible storm surge of more than 12 feet. Well, despite the threat, not everyone is leaving. Shelley Rudd lives in Galveston, and she says she and her family are staying put.
It's in the Lord's hands. We're putting it in the Lord's hands. All we can do is just pray. We'll be all right.
T.J. Alds is mainland editor for the Galveston County Daily News. And T.J., just based on your title, mainland editor, we need a reminder of the geography of Galveston, why it's so vulnerable that thousands died there in a hurricane back in 1900.
Yeah, for the basic part, Robin, that the Galveston Island is, for the lack of a better term, a barrier island that sits out there on its own. That's got the front entrance, basically, if you're coming from the Gulf of Mexico, and tied to the mainland area by two spans of the causeway. There's about 58,000 people who live on the island itself, and then you have the rest of the county, which is just as prone to the damage of the storm should it head this way.
We just heard a woman say that it's in the Lord's hands and she's not leaving, but does she represent many, especially after the pictures we saw coming from New Orleans? Are others staying?
There are others saying, some old stalwarts. There's a guy named Fletcher Harris here in Galveston that, and believe it or not, was in 1961 during Carla, the disaster manager and the Red Cross manager for the city. He says he's just too old to run from the storm, and he thinks the seawall will be enough to protect him. But for the most part, though, folks are getting out of town. The Katrina images, quite frankly, have had a major impact. And some old stalwarts that we've talked to that would normally stick around for a storm have decided that Rita's not one they want to mess with. So folks are taking it to heed and getting out of town.
And where are they going?
All over the Texas. There's a mandatory evacuation which begins at 6 o'clock this evening for those on the island and the low-lying areas of the county. Those folks will head northward of Houston to a community just north of Houston called Huntsville, better known for its prison system than it is for housing evacuees, obviously. Other folks will go to East Texas, and some will end up in San Antonio and Austin as well. It just depends on what part of the county you live in for those mandatory routes. But we're hearing from folks who are going as far as Dallas and the northern parts of Texas. Wherever they've got friends and family, if they can get out, they've already done so.
And we know you have some Katrina evacuees there as well, so they're obviously leaving again.
Yeah, we've spoken with many of those folks, and they are and they had no family to go to in the first place by getting here. Most of those folks, if not all of them, had found housing here and were setting up new lives, and now they find themselves having to head out. Most of those are going to the government-provided evacuation. There are school buses on Galveston Island that began running about an hour ago, the same in Texas City right across from Galveston, and other communities on the Galveston County mainland that had buses going. Most of those folks are going to go those, and they'll go to the larger shelters, as I said, north of Houston.
T.J. Olds, mainland editor for the Galveston County Daily News, the oldest newspaper in the Texas area, as the Galveston area there braces for Hurricane Rita, said to touch down either Friday night or Saturday. Right now, a Category 4 hurricane, and as she goes over those hot Gulf waters, it may get even bigger. So, TJ, thanks for keeping an eye on all of it for us.
Sure.
Well, while Rita bears down, rebuilding efforts are on hold on the eastern Gulf Coast, which is also bracing for some effects from the new storm. And it's not clear how New Orleans and the rest of the Gulf region will be rebuilt following Hurricane Katrina or how much it will cost. But plans are forming along party lines in Washington. That has become clear. Today, one group of deficit-conscious Republicans called the Republican Study Group is proposing one way to pay for reconstruction. They're calling it Operation Offset. It's a plan to shave $500 billion from federal spending, in part by delaying the start of the Medicare prescription drug benefit, eliminating NASA's Moon-Mars expedition, and ending support for the Corporation for Public Broadcasting. Well, joining us on the line from Washington is Wall Street Journal reporter Brody Mullins. And Brody, this same group has a plan for reconstruction, not just how to pay for it. And one congressman told you the effort to bring in conservative free market ideas is white hot. Who's in this study group, and how much planning has been going on?
Well, a lot of the same conservative Republicans who are now looking for ways to offset the new spending have come up with a set of conservative ideas that they would like to implement in rebuilding New Orleans. They see New Orleans as sort of a clean slate, a new canvas that they can sort of give a real test run to some of the conservative ideas that they've been pushing for 15, 20 years.
And what are some that have already taken place?
There's a school choice plan that's already been put into place. That's mm-hmm. something that Republicans have pushed for perhaps 20 years with only limited success. But here in a case where reconstruction efforts need to be approved very quickly to get the state back on its feet, they can sort of streamline that process and move some of the conservative ideas into place with minimal oversight.
And they also include lifting some environmental and wage labor restrictions?
Correct. Again, the whole idea is to make it easier, to reduce red tape, to make it a lot easier for the state to get back on its feet. And they say, you know, if you have to go through the normal process of getting environmental approvals, then it's going to take 2 to 3 years to build new structures.
Can you tick off some other ideas that are on the agenda of the Republican Study Group in particular, which has been pushing these ideas? Can you give us some others?
There are a whole slew of different tax credits that the Republicans are pushing for. A good one is accelerated depreciation, so it effectively costs less for companies to build in the area.
There's also been a suggestion of a temporary exemption from the estate tax. And do we understand possibly a second energy bill?
It really looks like there will be a second energy bill. The first energy bill took 4.5 years to pass, finally passed in August, right before the hurricane struck. And one of the things that the hurricane showed is that most of the U.S.'s refining capacity is concentrated in the Gulf Coast. So the idea is that we can move some oil refineries to different parts of the country, perhaps would be less susceptible to another natural or man-made disaster in that area.
What are some of the Democrats' proposals?
Democrats right now are pushing for more federal funding to schools, to employees. They want a big federal safety net so that you know, people have plenty of time to move back into the city. The difficulty is that they're running right smack into Republicans who control the White House, the House, and the Senate in Washington, who are already bristling at some of these new spending costs.
Well, there also have been ideas floated by conservatives to let victims withdraw money from retirement accounts without penalty.
Right.
There's an idea floated by liberals to let victims open low-cost bank accounts. Are there ideas that both sides of the aisle can agree on?
Yeah, I think most people agreed with the IRAs, the IRA idea, which would let people withdraw money from the IRAs tax-free. That's something that'll pass Congress and be signed by the president this week. The difficulty with a proposal like that is that the majority of people who have a lot of money in their IRAs are wealthy Americans. So to balance that, you need to find proposals that will help low-income Americans.
There's been a proposal by some conservative Republicans to make the entire region, the entire devastated region, a flat tax-free enterprise zone. As you said, sort of a petri dish to experiment with some of these policies. What's been the reaction from other Republicans? Is everybody on board with this?
Well, again, this is an idea, the enterprise zones, that Republicans have pushed for years. So I think most Republicans are behind that. Now, it's more difficult once the cost estimates come in, once the government says, okay, how much is it going to cost us in tax revenue down the road? And that's when the real battle will take place.
Right. You quote a former Reagan White House economic advisor who is at the Libertarian Cato Institute as saying, this could create expectations that we can do this every time a disaster hits. So it seems as if there's a fear on the part of even some Republicans that this could blow up like a big balloon.
Sure. And that spending battle is really heating up today and will be even bigger for the next week or two as Republicans and some Democrats are saying, where's this money coming from?
Brody Mullen, staff reporter for The Wall Street Journal in Washington, D.C. Brody, thanks for speaking with us.
Thanks very much.
Well, joining us now with his perspective is Republican Congressman Mark Souder of Indiana. Congressman, welcome.
Thank you.
And first of all, let's go to the how to pay for it. The Republican Study Committee came out today with this Operation Offset. That's an idea of cutting $500 billion from the budget to pay for Reconstruction. Do you agree with the idea of cutting that amount of money from social spending in order to pay for hurricane response?
Well, let me first make it clear. I'm a member of the Republican Study Committee. I don't believe even half the Republican Study Committee would support it. It's laughable on its face. I've been going through it this morning. We need to find some things. Probably the only thing we could do here to get any hope of passing something is an across-the-board cut. Because when you start to get into the particulars, we may find a fraction of these things we can move through. But this proposal to delay the Medicare bill, to slash huge payments to Medicaid, I'm chairman of the Narcotics Committee. They want to get rid of the HIDAs and the efforts against meth in the United States. Clearly, the Cato Institute.
Yep. Mm-hmm.
The Cato Institute clearly drove a lot of this, that opposes certain government entities. They oppose PBS, they oppose NEA, they oppose these different drug programs for years, and now they're hiding behind Hurricane Katrina to try to eliminate programs that aren't going to be eliminated.
So as we said, there's not total agreement within the party. And so
there's not agreement within the Republican Study Committee.
Yeah.
It's an isolated group in and of itself, and then, I mean, it's a conservative subgroup, but we don't agree inside the conservative subgroup.
Well, and we're talking about payment, but what about, you know, the plan for Reconstruction? Just touch on that, and for those who didn't hear, the Republican Study Group plan is pretty much to implement an agenda. It's been criticized on both sides of the aisle. Democratic Congressman Rahm Emanuel says it's an end run. It's a way to get things like school vouchers, which proponents of school vouchers weren't able to get through the legislative process. And some Republicans worry about massive spending to test these ideas. Congressman, do you worry that there's going to be blowback on the Republicans if they're seen as taking advantage of this disaster to push through an agenda?
There are two parts to the agenda. One is what you were just discussing down in New Orleans of whether we expand empowerment zones, which, of course, were backed by former President Clinton enthusiastically mm-hmm. as well. But how far you reach with that as it relates to in that zone, and then whether we try to use as an excuse to implement federal cuts that we would have never supported as a party before, which has zero chance of passing. It's a media phenomenon right now that Mike Pence and a few others are going on the media claiming there's this big support for these cuts. There aren't. What we need is some responsible cuts. We're going to need some creativity as to how we address New Orleans and Mississippi. I was there with the group this past weekend. It's a disaster that we haven't even begun to understand. Mm-hmm. And then we may be facing another one down in that zone as well. So it is a huge problem how to do it. There are other creative ways, too. You can, in rebuilding some of the highways and homes, really the cost isn't the cost of rebuilding the home itself. It's what's the low interest cost, because the loans will be repaid. You could do some of these bridges as toll roads or bonds that you could repay over time. So we have to look at multiple creative ways, and clearly the debt's going to increase. Just don't kid ourselves. Nobody's proposals even begin to cover the cost of this.
I was going to say that your fellow Republican Tom DeLay is sounding like a Democrat. He proposed allowing the deficit to grow, saying it'll stimulate the economy. Well, a Republican Mark Sauter, a congressman from Indiana, we really appreciate you taking some time with us today, and we'll check in with you again. Thank you. And just ahead, historian John Barry on how Hurricane Katrina may be changing attitudes towards government in the Gulf region. Much more ahead, here and now. Our conversation about reconstruction ideas for the Gulf region following Hurricane Katrina, perhaps Hurricane Rita as well. We've just heard from a reporter who described how politicized these ideas have become, and from a Republican congressman who demonstrates how even within his party it's causing such disarray. With us now on the line from Washington is historian John Barry, who also lives in New Orleans. He's the author of Rising Tide, The Great Mississippi Flood and How It Changed America. Welcome back, John.
Thanks for having me.
And I'm wondering, you know, as we listen to what we were just listening to, are you surprised by all the different disagreement and sort of elbowing for attention for people's different agendas in the aftermath of this flood and hurricane?
Not at all surprised. When you look at what happened after 9/11, when we had this great unity in the country, and the Bush administration used that as a vehicle to get through all sorts of things that had nothing to do with 9/11. Now, at least a lot of the ideas being discussed do in fact have something to do with rebuilding, whether they're good ideas or not, but they're also, you know, the camel's nose under the tent. And I think one thing that at least I didn't hear mentioned while I was listening that is very significant. And there was a story in both today's Times, New York Times and Washington Post, and there's a lot of evidence out there that the storm that actually hit New Orleans, the strength of the storm that hit New Orleans, was actually not Category 4 or even 3, that as it hit New Orleans, it was only the equivalent of a Category 2, which means the existing flood control protection system should have held, because they were designed for a Category 3, to hold a 3, and they failed. And that is a 100% federal responsibility. So if it's true that the storm was only the equivalent of a 2 as it hit the levee system in New Orleans, then that means that basically 100% of the devastation in the city is directly the result of a failure of a federal government agency, in which case, you know, the federal government, you know, has a real responsibility, a very direct responsibility for the damage.
I believe the articles you're talking about quoted members of the Army Corps of Engineers saying that they built it just to the distinction they were told to build it to and nothing more. In other words, this is how they were directed.
They believed that it would handle a Category 3. They were supposed to build Category 3 protection. And, in fact, the storm, from the evidence that I've seen, as it hit Lake Pontchartrain, was only the equivalent of a 2. In other words, it didn't, you know, the storm was well within the design capacity of the existing flood control system. Now, that remains to be demonstrated by an investigation, what the facts are.
But what does that tell you, John Barry, especially in light of your awareness of what happened after 1927? What does that tell us politically?
Well, I think morally it shifts. Yeah, I mean, a citizen can't sue the U.S. government unless the government gives it that citizen protection. But if a private contractor did something comparable in, you know, a totally private action, there would be lawsuits and clear liability. In this case, if it is true that the storm was not strong enough to exceed the design capacity, it clearly makes the federal government morally, ethically liable for the damage, and that changes the political equation quite a bit.
Do you think that gives, for instance, the Republicans less leeway to try out some of the social programs and different policy ideas that they're talking about in the region? What does it do?
One thing that it would certainly do would undermine those who criticize spending the money to fix the problem. In terms of what programs you precisely start on, you know, that debate would not really be affected. And, you know, there is no question that the New Orleans public school system was one of the worst in the country. I'm not a fan of vouchers personally, but by the same token, you know, I do think we need to try to rethink that but also, you know, that's my home. You know, I don't want someone from outside dictating to me what I do in my home. I think leaders need to have the dominant say in events.
Or experimenting with your home.
That's exactly right.
Hey, could you take us back to the flood of 1927? You've pointed out that then the federal government didn't pay a single penny for clothing, food, or shelter of 700,000 people who were left with nothing after that storm. But then things change. So, and obviously all programs were put in place. How might things change now?
Well, when you hear the president use phrases like the legacy of oppression, or a legacy of racism, or legacy of poverty, and talk about how racism is intimately involved with poverty, you know, these are not things that we're used to hearing from George Bush or, for that matter, very many Republicans. So this storm, like the events in 1927, sort of ripped off the covering fabric and revealed some things that lay underneath in American society that people would just as soon forget about. But we can't forget about them because they've been all over our TV screens. And the fact that Bush has already used language like that, which you'd be more used to hearing from Ted Kennedy, that's an indication of how the politics have begun to change. Now, whether or not this is really going to have a long-lasting and deep impact on American politics remains to be seen. In 1927, as you said, there were 700,000 people being fed by the Red Cross. Not a single federal dollar went to any of them. The American people did not accept that, and it changed the way they looked at the responsibility of the federal government toward individual citizens, as well as the federal government's power vis-a-vis the states.
Historian John Barry, he's author of Rising Tide, The Great Mississippi Flood, and How It Changed America. We hope to have you back again, John, but it sounds as if you're saying there might be some change this time around as well.
I think so.
Yeah. John Barry, thanks as always.
Okay, take care.
And stay with us. Much more ahead, here and now.
Funding for Here and Now comes from WBU.
Among the winners of this year's MacArthur Genius Grant, a lobsterman who's working to increase fish stocks in Maine, a Michigan musician who crafts world-class violins, and an emissions expert who's trying to make your car engine spout less pollution. 25 people were awarded the MacArthur Grant for genius and creativity in their field. It comes with a no-strings-attached $500,000 prize. And today in the studio, we're joined by one of the winners, Dr. Sue Goldie of Harvard School of Public Health. She was awarded for her work in the field of decision science. Welcome, Doctor, and I have to say, there was obviously no genius behind your chair. In the last few seconds, as you sat down, your chair just sort of sank. You're sort of we're both reacting to that in here, and we'll adjust you as we go along. But what is decision science? That's your field. What does that mean?
Decision science is actually a not popular term. People don't understand it and haven't had it in college. It's simply put the science of decision making under conditions of uncertainty.
And further, you sort of do models to kind of figure out risk and benefit?
Well, yes, partly. A theme in decision science is we use elements of economics, statistics, psychology to look at problems that have multiple components and then there's uncertainty around those components. So, for example, if you wanted to know is drug A better than drug B, you might design a randomized controlled trial and answer that question. But if you were a public health official looking at a complex question of how to introduce a vaccination program and take into account the costs, the benefits, how to achieve coverage, decision science is a way to incorporate those complicated elements into a quantitative analysis.
Well, we know, for instance, the first decision science paper you wrote was on the cost effectiveness of airbags by seating position. So you had to, you know, judge each one. Is it really about just about cost and benefit? Is that...
You know, of course not. I think that's an often misunderstood cost effectiveness analysis, which is what you're referring to, is actually only one small component of decision science. So what we'll generally do is faced with a problem, specify the alternatives, and try to elucidate what the consequences of each of those alternatives are. And by consequences, I mean clinical benefits to the individual, the public health impact to the population, and sometimes economic consequences. Like costs.
Yeah, and I know that you have applied these models to things that have become your passion. I'm thinking, for instance, of your work on the human papillomavirus, which causes cervical cancer. Your work will help women everywhere, but in particular in the third world, you visited Haiti and were inspired there by the number of women. By the way, why do so many women in Haiti have cervical cancer?
Actually, so many women all over the world that aren't in countries without screening have cervical cancer. Mm-hmm. And it's not really known, but about 95% of cervical cancer deaths in this world are in countries without screening programs.
Yeah.
Lifetime risk of cervical cancer for a woman living in Haiti or Brazil probably exceeds 5 to 8%.
So how would you apply and how have you applied decision science to the human papilloma virus, which causes
So, for example, with HPV, women acquire HPV when they become sexually active, so at a very young age. And pretty much, if you're sexually active, you are going to be exposed to HPV at some point. Cervical cancer is a long natural history, and you get the disease in your late 30s and 40s. The way someone asks questions about what the best ways to prevent and treat cervical cancer are can't be answered by one study, and so we develop a model. And we take a biologic model of that virus and that disease, we overlay it and into the country or region we're interested in, and then we can use that model like a public health laboratory to ask about different interventions and what the costs, benefits, and outcomes might be.
And I know that this is rewarding and that you can show that there's a tremendous benefit, I'm assuming, to treating women. But I am also wondering for you, because I've read some accounts of how you've made trips and met women who are suffering from this horrendous disease, which is avoidable, you know, through screening. And isn't there a part of you that just wants to say, why do I need a model? I should just be able to say there's women who have cervical cancer, go treat them.
The problem is that they haven't been able to be treated. There are not the resources or the operational research on how to deliver very simple technologies to these women. I think with the modeling work and the analysis we've done, we've actually been able to put together lots of different information from different studies to come up with alternatives that are not quite as complex as cervical cytology or the pap smear that are more feasible in developing countries.
Right.
And the elucidation of those types of approaches have allowed that next step to happen.
Right, so you actually are able to get them the help they need by doing the modeling.
Right.
And now you have won this award. Did you wake up feeling like a genius?
No, and I still don't. And I think the foundation doesn't really call it that, but the public finds that so, you know, exciting that they say it, and it is cool. But I think, you know, the foundation really thinks about, you know, creative approaches to problems.
What might you do with that $500,000? How might that help your work?
I haven't thought too much. It's only been a few days. But I think, you know, there's a couple of themes I've thought about. One is something special, something really important for public health, and something that would be hard to get funded in another way.
And how are your colleagues reacting to this? I mean, what does this do to this thing that a lot of us had not heard of, decision science?
I think my colleagues, both in decision science and in my Department of Health Policy at the School of Public Health, have, of course, been incredibly gracious and congratulatory. I think for my colleagues, especially in decision science, which is such an misunderstood and underutilized field, I think it's a great opportunity to help showcase what these methods can do. And an important point is that decision science and these kinds of models don't give an answer. What they do is help elucidate what the options are, what the trade-offs are, so that we can put our own values into those problems.
From airbags to the human papillomavirus, what are some of the other ways you hope to either use it or have used decision science modeling?
We're really using these approaches across a range of public health problems. I, in particular, work on viruses, AIDS, HIV, hepatitis, HPV, all of which cause big public health problems, morbidity, mortality, quality of life, and economic costs. And we look at a range of other big global health problems using these techniques.
And again, what's in the future? What's a dream of application?
A dream is to use resources wisely so that we can provide the maximum benefit to populations, and in particular those that are disadvantaged.
Yeah, and I know in just the few seconds we have, there was one woman in particular. You saw so many women in Haiti, but there was one in particular in just the time that we have that inspired some of this work.
There was a woman in Haiti who we were examining for our screening program who had late-stage incurable cervical cancer, and her impact is just go home, work harder.
Yeah. I hope, I hope it resonates in Haiti, the award that's won here. Dr. Sue Goldie, an associate professor of health decision science at Harvard School of Public Health, congratulations and thanks for speaking with us.
Thank you very much.
Thank you. Well, while Dr. Sue Goldie used the most sophisticated computer modeling in her research, Maine scientist and lobster man Ted Ames turned to his fellow fishermen. Ames also won a MacArthur Award for his project, combining scientific research with generations of fishing folk tales to restore depleted fish stocks in the Gulf of his native Maine. And fisherman and scientist Ted Ames joins us now on the line from Maine. Welcome.
Well, thank you.
Well, you know, no one can apply for a MacArthur grant. They call you. So what was your reaction when you got your call?
I was blown away. It was just wonderful.
Well, tell us about the work that they have applauded. What exactly did you do?
When cod stocks started collapsing back in the 90s, I and a great many other fishermen got together and resolved that hatcheries could help reinvigorate the fishery. So we funded a legislative study to find out whether this might be possible. And the results of that came back that, no, you could not create put-and-take fishery this way, but if juveniles were released in the general vicinity of historical spawning areas, that there's a very good chance that you could jumpstart these populations back into productivity.
And that historical spawning area idea is where the other fishermen came in, because you had to ask them to reconstruct, you know, where the cod were back in the 20s and 30s.
Precisely. We collectively picked out the very best cod and haddock fishermen that had been operating back in the 30s, 40s, and 50s. I had the great pleasure of going around and talking with these old curmudgeon fishermen who were so talented.
Well, and you being a scientist, you could plot the things they told you on computer mapping programs that showed you where these old spawning and nursery fish areas used to be.
Yes. I conducted those interviews from the eastern end of Maine all the way to Ipswich Bay. In the process, I had to develop a protocol that would allow me to validate the information I was collecting. And I was successful in doing that, and all told, we gathered from those dozens of fishermen something like 1,000 square miles of spawning habitat that was heretofore unknown by the scientific community. But it also, I think, was important is that it provided a mechanism for taking colloquial information from fishermen and enable the scientific community to use that.
And in addition to a scientific purpose, you've just preserved these voices. Can you just briefly, and I know that's hard for a storyteller from Maine, but can you just, if one of the stories comes to mind, I mean, can you just share it with us?
Oh, yes, one wonderful one. I talked to the crewman and son of the Royal. This was back in 1942. One day around town meeting time, he went out with his boat and made a tow just outside the mouth of the harbor, and appeared to hang down, so he stopped the engine and hauled his net to the surface and found that it was filled to the jaws with 4- and 5-foot-long codfish. Mm. He tried to hoist the cod end aboard, but the bull rope that allowed him to do that broke, so he towed the whole net into Jonesport, ran it up into a cove, and when the tide left, they took the fish out. And that single short tow yielded 50,000 pounds of codfish that were sold in the Rockland market. Those were the days.
Well, now, because of your project, there will be places hopefully set aside for the fish to spawn and reproduce and regenerate the industry. But so here you are, $500,000 later. What are you going to do with that money?
Oh, I have lots of projects going. We're building a lobster hatchery here in Stonington, the Penobscot East Resource Center, and I had agreed to design and construct it this summer, and we'll go online next spring.
Ted Ames, a Maine lobsterman and scientist, and to his delight and surprise, the winner of one of this year's MacArthur Genius Grants. I was thinking as well, Ted, you could get a new pair of waders. Something like that.
Where I'm fishing, it wouldn't do me much good. I can't touch bottom.
Okay, a lobster pot. Something for yourself.
Yes, indeed.
Ted, thank you.
And thank you.
The London Telegraph nominated Seyou Jorge the coolest man on the planet for singing samba-influenced David Bowie tunes in Wes Anderson's film The Life Aquatic with Steve Zissou, for starring in the Oscar-nominated film City of God. While now critics are raving about his new CD, Crew, just released in the U.S., Seyou Jorge worked his way up from changing tires in the slums of Rio de Janeiro to singing in clubs and acting, and now he adds fashion icon to the list. He's featured in the premiere issue of Men's Vogue, and a very fashion-forward Seyou Jorge joins us now in the studio. Welcome.
Muito obrigado. Thank you.
And we're also joined by a translator, Graciela Silva, who's going to help us out here today. Graciela, thanks to you as well.
Thank you.
And you know, I have to point out, by the way, what may I call you? Seyou means Mr., correct?
No, no, é verdade. Seu.
Seu in Portuguese means not only sir and mister, but also means yours. And in my case, I believe that it means your friend, your musician, yours in general.
You gained a large following in as the singing sailor from the film The Life Aquatic. This is a character, for those who haven't seen the film, who just appears every now and then singing, you know, as an interpreter of David Bowie tunes. How much did you have input on creating that part, by the way?
He called me on my house, and it was a big surprise. First, I thought I was going to play the soccer player, and this would be the problem for me since I don't play soccer. I didn't know. When I got to the set, he told me that he wanted me to play 18 tunes of David Bowie's music, and I didn't know much about David Bowie since nobody plays him in favelas. I just knew a little bit.
The slums of Rio.
Yeah, in the slums of Rio. So, but I loved it. And I think the simplicity of his music was very important to me, and I assimilated a lot of it in my own music. I think the concept of less is more really taught me a lot. And in general, I'm just very proud, especially as a Brazilian and as a black Brazilian, since there are not many opportunities for black actors in Brazil. So in general, I'm just very happy with the opportunity he gave to me.
I want to ask you about your new CD, Crew. I just want to sample a little bit more music. This is the song A Woman.
Uma mulher brasileira, um avião tropical.
The songs on Crew are beautiful. It's that sort of sensual, romantic side of Brazil. First of all, how did you come to shape this album? What did you want to say?
Eu queria fazer uma música que não fosse necessariamente...
I tried to make music that was not overly produced. I wanted to do simple music. Someone in France told me that my music looked like blues from the favelas, from the slums, because I wanted to do it with emotion, from the heart, and I think that's why it's so similar to blues. It was a CD taught for the French public, especially, because they are always very interested in Brazilian music. In the U.S., it's coming little by little, but I think the French has always been more interested in what's going on in Brazilian music. And I also wanted to do a CD that could be easily played in the same way on stage. I wanted something that it was a small production, and it's very easy to do this concert when you only have like percussion, guitar, and voice, and you don't have other types of more difficult instruments that you need more production. And in a way, what I want is that music to be above me and not I above the music.
But again, it's very pretty, and nothing wrong with that, but I'm just wondering, you know, here, your story would make some people angry. Grew up in the favelas, the slums of Rio. Your brother was murdered. You became a street kid. Did you ever consider going instead towards angry rap?
É, eu posso entender que você está dizendo...
I think that people in favela, they want equality. They don't want difference. And I think it would not be me if I tried to be different and try to have like this anger. Although I was poor, I was very lucky because I had a very good, a great father and a great mother, and they raised me with a lot of love. And I think I brought this to my music and also to my life. I have two kids, and now I'm expecting another one, and I love to be a father, and I love my children. And I think that in general, people have to work to be equal, and that's what people are trying to do in the favelas.
Another question about the music on the CD. Elvis makes an appearance. Why Elvis?
Por que o Elvis?
I chose Elvis because he's a black artist. He grew up in a black neighborhood. He danced black music. He sings black music. In a way, he's giving it back to me. Now I am representing him instead of him representing the black singers and the black musicians. In addition to that, he's an actor and a musician, and he never had to explain if he was one thing or the other. He's from a time that people could do that. Fred Astaire, Frank Sinatra, and all those people who could do all those things and be complete artists. And the music, it's just so beautiful. The message it says, don't say no.
Let's listen.
Don't, that's what you say. It's time that I hold you this way.
You know immediately you're not in Memphis. What's that instrument? That's a cuíca.
Porque a cuíca no Brasil, ela
yes, it is a cuíca. And usually cuíca is not the main instrument in a music as it is used for samba. And I wanted to use the cuíca as a solo instrument. And I thought this gave a very interesting sound.
Oh, sure. Memphis meets Rio. It sure does. And I just wondered if you can play something for us now, Cero, something here in the studio.
I'm going to sing a music by Milton Nascimento, since you are friends with him.
Milton Nascimento, another Brazilian superstar. Muito obrigado.
Muito obrigado a você. Muito obrigado. Adorei a entrevista.
Com sol e chuva, você sonhava. Queria ser melhor depois. Você queria ser o grande herói das estradas. Tudo que você queria ser.
To find out more about Seu Jorge and his new CD, Crew, visit our website, here-now.org.
Sei segredo, você tem medo. Só pensa agora em voltar, não fala mais na porta e no anel de sapata. Tudo que você queria ser.
Here and Now is a production of WBUR Boston. I'm Robin Young. We're going to let you listen for a while. Join us again, Here and Now.
Não importa, não faz mal. Você ainda pensa, é melhor do que nada. Tudo que você queria ser. Oh!
Posso me ouvir? Cara sagaz sem problema, direto do gogó da M. Eu vou do S para o E, para o U, espaço J para o O, para o R, para o G e para o E. Seu Jorge representando a cultura hip hop. Não tem Gugu nem Faustão, eu sou primeiro de pop. Revolução, vou fazer de maneira diferente. Tirando longe do coração, compadre, tentando usar mais a mente. Botam barreira na minha frente, mas sou persistente. Posso cair, mas me levanto e me sigo em frente. Segura a bronca, davam dois e mantenha a calma.
Funding for Here and Now comes from the MathWorks, creators of MATLAB and Simulink technical computing software. On the web at mathworks.com.
I'm Robin Young. Join us next